Hours each day, which were nominally free, David could not spend napping or dreaming in the quiet of the school's library, but must, perforce, spend in sweaty exercise. Worse still, some sports were not only excessively energetic, but also involved hazards to David's favorite skin. Boxing. This is a long-forgotten, utterly useless, stylized mock combat in which two men batter each other for a preset period or until one is beaten unconscious. Lacrosse. This is a mock battle taken over from the savages who had formerly inhabited that continent. In it, mobs of men fought with clubs. There was a hard missile with which points were scored, but it was the prospect of being sliced open or having bones broken with these clubs that aroused our hero's distaste. There was a thing called water polo, in which opposing swimmers attempted to drown each other. David avoided that one by not swimming more than well enough to stay in school, a required skill. He was an excellent swimmer, having learned at the age of 7 through being chucked into a creek by 2 older cousins, but he concealed his skill. The sport with highest prestige was a thing called football. And first-classmen sized up each new group of victims for candidates who might be expected to excel or learn to excel in this organized mayhem. David had never seen it, but now he saw it, and it filled his peaceful soul with horror. As well it might, it involved 2 gangs of 11 men facing each other on a field and trying to move an ellipsoid bladder down the field against the opposition of the other gang. There were rituals and an esoteric terminology, but that was the idea. It sounds harmless and rather foolish. Foolish it was, harmless it was not, as the rituals permitted the opposing gang to attack a man attempting to move the bladder in a variety of violent ways, the least of which was to grab him and cause him to hit the ground like a ton of bricks. Often, 3 or 4 hit him at once, and sometimes inflicted indignities and mayhems not permitted by the rituals, but concealed by the pile of bodies. Death was not supposed to result from this activity, but sometimes did. Injuries short of death were commonplace. Unfortunately, David had the ideal physique for success in this feetball. Height, weight, eyesight, fleetness of foot, speed of reflex. He was certain to be spotted by the first classmen on their return from mock sea battles and volunteered as a sacrificial victim. It was time for evasive action. The only possible way to avoid football was to be acceptably occupied with some other sport. He found one. Ira, do you know what swordsmanship is? Huh? Oh, good. I can speak freely. This was a time in Earth's history when the sword had ceased to be a weapon, after having been prominent for more than 4 millennia. But swords still existed in fossil form and retained a shadow of their ancient prestige. A gentleman was presumed to know how to use a sword, and... Lazarus, what is a gentleman?
What? Don't interrupt, boy. You confuse me. A gentleman is, Well, now let me see. A general definition. My, you can't think of some hard ones. Some said it was an accident of birth. That being a disparaging way of saying it was a trait genetically inherited. But that doesn't say what the trait is. A gentleman was supposed to prefer being a dead lion to being a live jackal. Me? I've always preferred to be a live lion, so that puts me outside the rules. You could say in all seriousness that the quality tagged by that name represents the slow emergence in human culture of an ethic higher than simple self-interest. Damn slow in emerging, in my opinion. You still can't rely on it in a crunch. As may be. Military officers were presumed to be gentlemen and wore swords. Even flyers wore swords, although Allah alone could guess why. These cadets were not only presumed to be gentlemen. There was a national law which stated that they were gentlemen. So they were taught a bare minimum about how to handle a sword. Just enough to keep them from slicing their fingers or stabbing bystanders. Not enough to fight with them. Just to keep them from looking too silly when protocol required them to wear swords.
but swordsmanship was a recognized sport called, fencing, yeah. It had none of the prestige of football, or boxing, or even water polo, but it was on the list. A plebe could sign up for it. David spotted this as a way out. Under a simple physical law, if he was up in the fencing loft, then he was not down on the football field with sadistic gorillas in hobnailed boots jumping up and down on him. Long before the upperclassmen returned to school, plebe cadet Lamb had established himself as a member of the fencing squad, with a record of never missing a day, and was trying hard to look like a good prospect for the team. At that time and place, three forms of fencing were taught: saber, dueling sword, and foil. The first two used full-sized weapons. True, edges were dulled and points were baited. Nevertheless, a man could get hurt with them, even fatally, though that was very rare. But the foil was a lightweight toy, a fake sword with a limber blade that bent at the slightest pressure. The stylized imitation swordplay that used the foil was about as dangerous as tiddlywinks. This was the weapon David selected. It was made for him. The highly artificial rules of foil fencing gave great advantage to fast reflexes and a sharp brain, both of which he had. Some exertion was necessary, but not much compared with football, lacrosse, or even tennis. Best of all, it required no body-against-body pounding that David found so distasteful in the rough games he was avoiding. David applied himself single-mindedly to acquiring skill so that his haven would be secure. So diligent was he in protecting his sanctuary that before his plebe year was over, he was National Novice Foil Champion. This caused his squad leader to smile at him, an expression that hurt his face. His cadet company commander noticed him for the first time and congratulated him. Success with the foil even got him out of some punishment beatings. One Friday evening when he was about to be beaten for some imaginary dereliction, David said, "Sir, if it's the same to you, I'd rather have twice as many swats on Sunday, because tomorrow we're fencing the Princeton plebe team, and if you do the job I know you can do, it might slow me up tomorrow." The first classman was impressed by this because having the Navy win at any time and for any purpose and in anything took precedence by sacred law over anything else, even the righteous pleasure of beating a smart-ass plebe. He answered, "Tell you what, mister, report to my room after supper on Sunday. If you lose tomorrow, you get a double dose of the medicine you've got coming to you. But if you win, we'll cancel it." David won all three of his matches. Fencing got him through his perilous plebe year with his precious skin unmarked save for scars on his bottom. He was safe now, with three easy years ahead of him, for only a plebe was subject to physical punishment. Only a plebe could be ordered to take part in organized mayhem. One body contact sport David loved, one of ancient popularity, which he had learned back in those hills he had fled from, but it was played with girls and was not officially recognized at this school. There were harsh rules against it, and a cadet caught practicing it was kicked out without mercy. But David, like all true geniuses, paid only pragmatic attention to rules made by other people. He obeyed the 11th commandment and never got caught. While other cadets sought the empty prestige of sneaking girls into the barracks or went over the wall at night in search of girls, David kept his activities quiet. Only those who knew him well knew how industriously he pursued this one body contact sport. And no one knew him well. Huh? Female cadets? Didn't I make that plain, Ira? Not only were there no girl cadets, there was not one girl in that Navy. Except a few nurses. Most particularly, there were no girls at that school. There were guards night and day to keep them away from the cadets. Don't ask me why. It was Navy policy and therefore did not have a reason. In truth, there was no job in that entire Navy which could not have been performed by either sex or even by eunuchs. But, by long tradition, that Navy was exclusively male. Come to think of it, a few years later that tradition was questioned. A little at first, then by the end of that century, shortly before the collapse, that Navy had females at all levels. I am not suggesting that this change was a cause of the collapse. There were obvious causes of the collapse, causes I won't go into now. This change either was a null factor or possibly postponed the inevitable by a minor amount. Either way, it doesn't figure into the tale of the lazy man. When David was in school, cadets were supposed to encounter females, but seldom, and only under highly stylized circumstances, rigidly bound protocol and heavily chaperoned. Footnote. From the noun chaperone, this word has two meanings. One, a person charged with preventing sexual contacts between males and females, not licensed for such contacts. Two, a person superficially performing such disservice while in fact acting as a benign lookout. It appears that the senior uses the word here in its first meaning rather than in its antithetical second meaning. See appendix. Justin Foote, the 45th. Instead of fighting the rules, David looked for loopholes and made use of them. He was never caught. Every impossible rule has its loopholes. Every general prohibition creates its bootleggers. The Navy, as a whole, created its impossible rules. The Navy, as individuals, violated them, especially its curious rules about sex. A publicly monastic life on duty, a slightly veiled life of unlimited voluptuousness off duty. At sea, even harmless reliefs from sexual tension were treated most harshly when detected. Although such technical violations of the mores were expected and condoned less than a century earlier. But this Navy was only a little more hypocritical in its sexual behavior than was the social matrix in which it was embedded. More excessive in its outlets only to the degree that its public rules were more sternly impossible than those of that society as a whole. The public sexual code of that time, was unbelievable, Ira. The violations of it simply mirrored in reverse its fantastic requirements. To every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction, if you'll excuse the obvious. I did not intend to discuss this other than to say that David found ways to get along with the school's regulations about sex without going completely off his nut, as too many of his classmates did. I'll add only this, and this is merely rumor. Through a mischance, all too easy then, although unheard of today, a young woman became pregnant, presumably by David. In those days, believe me, this was a major disaster. Why? Just stipulate that it was a disaster. It would take forever to explain that society, and no civilized human would believe it. Cadets were forbidden to marry. The young woman had to get married under the rules current then. Intervention to correct this mischance was almost unobtainable and physically very dangerous for her. What David did about it illustrates his whole approach to life. When faced with a choice of evils, accept the least hazardous and cope with it unblinkingly. He married her. How he managed to do this and not get caught, I do not know. I can think of a number of ways, some simple and fairly foolproof, some complex and thereby subject to breakdown. I assume that David selected the simplest. It changed the situation from impossible to manageable. It converted the girl's father from an enemy, all too likely to go to the commandant of the school with the story and thereby force David to resign when he had but a few months more to reach his goal, into an ally and fellow conspirator anxious to keep the marriage secret so that his son-in-law could graduate and take his wayward daughter off his hands. As a side benefit, David no longer needed to give planning to the pursuit of his favorite sport. He spent his time off in unworried domesticity with perfect chaperonage. Footnote. Context implies second meaning. Justin Foote, the 45th. As for the rest of David's career in school, one may assume that a lad who could substitute 6 weeks of unsupervised reading for 4 years of formal schooling could also stand first in his class academically. This would pay off in money and rank, as a young officer's place on the promotion list was determined by his standing at graduation. But the competition for first place is sharp indeed, and, worse, makes the cadet who achieves it conspicuous. David became aware of this when he was a fresh-caught plebe. "Mister, are you a savior?" that is to say, academically brainy, was another trick question. A plebe was damned whether he answered yes or no. But standing second, or even tenth, was practically as useful as first place. David noticed something else. The fourth year counted four times as much as the first. The next to the last year, three times as much, and so on down. That is, a plebe's marks did not affect his final standing much, only one part in ten. David decided to maintain a low profile, always the smart decision when one is likely to be shot at. He finished the first half of his plebe year a little above midway in his class. Safe, respectable, and conspicuous. He ended his plebe year in the upper quarter, but by that time the first classmen were thinking only of graduation and paid no attention to his status. His second year he moved to the upper 10%. His third year he improved that by a few numbers, and his last year, when it counted most, he went all out and finished with a final standing for 4 years of sixth, but effectively second, for of those higher in ranking, two elected to leave the line of command for specialization. One was not commissioned because he had damaged his eyes by studying too hard, and one resigned after he graduated. But the care with which David managed his class standing does not show his true talent for laziness. After all, sitting down and reading was his second favorite pastime, and anything which merely called for excellent memory and logical reasoning was no effort to him. During the mock warfare cruise that opened David's last year of school, a group of his classmates were discussing what cadet ranks each would receive. By then, they knew pretty well which ones would be selected as cadet officers. Jake is certain to be a cadet corps commander, unless he falls overboard. Who gets his battalion? Steve or Stinky? Someone suggested that Dave was in line for that battalion. Dave had been listening instead of talking, a standard feature of his low profile. Ah, and very nearly a third way to lie, Ira, and easier than its equivalent, talking while saying nothing, and also tends to give the non-talker a reputation for wisdom. Never cared for it myself. Talking is the second of the three real pleasures in life, and only one thing that sets us apart from the apes, though just barely. Now, David broke, or appeared to break, his habitual reserve. "No battalion for me," he said. "No, indeedy. I'm going to be regimental adjutant and stand out in front where the girls can see me." Perhaps his remark wasn't taken seriously. Regimental adjutant is lower than battalion commander, but it was certain to be repeated, and David knew it. Perhaps by the prospective cadet regimental commander to commissioned officers making the selections for cadet officers. No matter. David was chosen regimental adjutant. By military organization of that time, a regimental adjutant did stand out in front, all alone, where female visitors could hardly avoid seeing him. But one may doubt that this figured into Dave's plans. The regimental adjutant attends no formations other than full regimental formations. He goes to and from classes alone, instead of marching or being marched. Other first classmen are responsible each for some unit of cadets, be it a squad, platoon, company, battalion, or regiment. The regimental adjutant has no such responsibilities and only one minor administrative task. He keeps the watch list for the most senior of the cadet officers. But he is not on that watch list himself. Instead, he is a supernumerary who fills in when one of them is ill. And this was the lazy man's prize. Those cadet officers were perfect specimens, and the chances that one would be too ill to take his day's duty ranged from negligible to zero. For 3 years, our hero had been standing watch about every tenth day. These watches weren't difficult, but they involved either getting to bed a half hour late or getting up a half hour early, and much standing on tired feet, all an affront to David's tender regard for his comfort. But his last year, David stood only 3 watches, and he stood, though sitting down, as junior officer of the watch. At last the day arrived. David graduated, was commissioned, then went to the chapel and remarried his wife. If her belly bulged a little, that was not unusual in Bryan's, even in those days, and was always ignored and condoned once a young couple married. It was widely known, though rarely mentioned, that an eager young bride could accomplish in 7 months or less what takes 9 for a cow or countess. Dave was safely past all rocks and shoals. He need never again fear going back to that mule and honest work. But life as a junior officer in a warship turned out to be less than perfect. It had good points. Servants, a comfortable bed, easy work that rarely got David's hands dirty, and twice as much money. But he needed that and more to support a wife, and his ship was at sea enough that he often lacked the pleasant compensations of marriage. Worst of all, he stood heel-to-toe watches on a short watch list. This meant a 4-hour night watch about every other night, standing up. He was sleepy much of the time, and his feet hurt. So David applied for training as an aeronaut. This Navy had recently grasped an idea called air power, and was trying to grab as much of it as possible in order to keep it out of the wrong hands. The Army's hands, that is. They were behind, as the Army had grabbed first, so volunteers for flying were welcome. David was quickly ordered to shore duty to see if he had the makings of an aeronaut. He had indeed. He not only had the mental and physical qualities, but also was highly motivated. As his new work was done sitting down, whether in classroom or in the air, and he stood no night watches and received pay and a half for sitting down and sleeping at home, flying was classed as hazardous duty and extra pay was awarded. I had best say something about these aeroplanes, since they resemble not at all the aerodynes you are used to. In a way, they were hazardous. So was breathing. They were not as hazardous as the automotive ground vehicles then in use, and not nearly as hazardous as being a pedestrian. Accidents, fatal and otherwise, usually could be traced to a mistake on the part of the aeronaut. David never let that sort of accident happen to him. He had no wish to be the hottest pilot in the sky. He merely wanted to be the oldest. Aeroplanes were weird monstrosities, looking like nothing in the sky today, save possibly a child's kite. They were often called kites. They had two wings, one above the other, and the aeronaut sat between them. A small baffle helped to deflect wind from his face. Don't look surprised. These flimsy structures flew very slowly, pulled through the air by a powered screw. Wings were made of varnished cloth held rigid by struts. You can see from this alone that their speeds could never be any large fraction of the speed of sound, except on sad occasions when an overly eager pilot would dive straight down, then pull the wings off through trying too abruptly to recover a normal altitude, which David never did. Some people are natural flyers. The first time David examined an aeroplane, he understood its strengths and weaknesses as thoroughly as he understood the milking stool he had left behind him. He learned to fly almost as quickly as he had learned to swim. His instructor said, "Dave, you're a natural. I'm going to recommend you for fighter training." Fighter pilots, were the royalty of aeroplane flyers. They went up and engaged enemy pilots in single combat. A fighter who did this successfully 5 times, killed the opposing pilot instead of being killed, was called an ace, which was a high honor, for, as you can see, the average chance of doing this is the 1/5, or 1 in 32, whereas the chance of getting killed instead is the complement, close to certainty. Dave thanked his mentor while his skin crawled and his brain went whir-click as he considered ways to avoid this honor without giving up pay and a half and the comfort of sitting down. There were other disadvantages to being a fighter pilot besides the prime hazard of getting your ass shot off by some stranger. Fighter pilots flew in one-man kites and did their own navigation, without computers, homing devices, or anything that would be taken for granted today, or even later that century. The method used was called dead reckoning, because if you didn't reckon it correctly, you were dead, since Navy flying was done over water. from a small floating aerodrome, with a margin of safety and fuel for a fighter plane of only minutes. Add to this the fact that a fighter pilot in combat had to choose between doing navigation or giving single-minded attention to attempting to kill a stranger before that stranger killed him. If he wanted to be an ace, or even eat dinner that night, he must put first things first and worry about navigation later. In addition to the chance of being lost at sea and drowned in a kite that was out of gas. Did I say how these things were powered? The air screw was driven by an engine powered by a chemical exothermic reaction. Oxidation of a hydrocarbon fluid called gas, which it was not. If you think this is unlikely, I assure you that it was unlikely even then. The method was woefully inefficient. A flyer was not only likely to run out of gas with nothing around him but ocean, but also this temperamental engine often coughed and quit. Embarrassing. Sometimes fatal. The lesser drawbacks to being a fighter pilot were not all physical danger. They simply did not fit David's master plan. Fighter pilots were assigned to floating aerodromes, or carriers. In peacetime, which this nominally was, a flyer did not work too hard nor stand many watches and spent much of his time ashore at a land aerodrome, even though he was carried on the muster rolls of a carrier ship, thereby credited with sea duty necessary for promotion and pay. But for several weeks each year, a flyer assigned to a carrier ship would actually be at sea, practicing mock warfare, which involved getting up an hour before dawn to warm those cantankerous engines and stand by, ready to fly at the first hint of real or simulated danger. David hated this. He would not willingly attend Judgment Day if it was held before noon. There was another drawback. Landing on these floating aerodromes. On land, David could land on a dime and give back change. But that depended on his own skill, highly developed because his own skin was at stake. But landing on a carrier depended on another pilot's skill, and David held a dark opinion of entrusting his skin to the skill, good intentions, and alertness of someone else. Ira, this is so unlike anything you are likely to have seen in your life that I am at a loss. Consider your skyport here at New Rome. In landing, a ship is controlled from the ground, right? So it was with airplanes, landing on carriers. But the analogy breaks down because a landing on a carrier in those days used no instruments. None. I'm not fooling. It was done by eye alone. Just as a boy in a game of catch snatches a ball out of the air, but David was the ball, and the skill used to catch him was not his own, but that of a pilot standing on the carrier. David had to suppress his own skill, his own opinions, and place utter faith in the pilot on the carrier. Anything less brought disaster. David had always followed his own opinion, against the whole world if necessary. To place that much faith in another man ran counter to his deepest emotions. A carrier landing was like baring his belly to a surgeon and saying, "Go ahead and cut." When he was not sure that surgeon was competent to slice ham. Carrier landing came closer to causing David to give up pay and a half and easy hours than any other aspect of flying. So torn was he by the necessity of accepting another pilot's decision, and one not even sharing his danger at that. It took all his willpower to do it the first time, and it never became easy. But he learned one lesson that he never expected to learn. That is, that there were circumstances in which another man's opinion was not only better than his own, but incomparably better. You see, no, perhaps you don't. I have not explained the circumstances. An aeroplane landed on a carrier in a controlled crash, through a hook on its tail catching a wire rope stretched across the top deck. But if the flyer follows his own judgment based on experience in landing on a flying field, he is certain to crash into the stern of the ship, or if he knows this and tries to allow for it, he will fly too high and miss the rope. Instead of a big flat field and plenty of room for minor mistakes, he has only a tiny window which he must hit precisely. Neither right nor left, nor up nor down, nor too fast nor too slow. But he can't see what he is doing well enough to judge these variables correctly. Later on, the process was made semi-automatic, then automatic. But when it was finally perfected, carriers for aeroplanes were obsolete. A capsule description of most human progress. But by the time you learn how, it's too late. But it often turns out that what you have learned applies to some new problem, or we would still be swinging from trees. So the flyer in the aeroplane must trust a pilot on deck who can see what is going on. He was called the landing signal officer and used wigwag flags to signal orders to the aeroplane's pilot. The first time David tried this unlikely stunt, he chased around the sky three times for fresh approaches before he controlled his panic, quit trying to override the judgment of the LSO, and was allowed to land. Only then did he discover how scared he was. His bladder cut loose. That evening, he was awarded a fancy certificate, the Royal Order of the Wet Diaper, signed by the LSO, endorsed by his squadron commander, witnessed by his squadron mates. It was a low point in his life, worse than any his plebe year, and it was little consolation that the order was awarded so frequently that certificates were kept ready and waiting for each new group of still-damp flyers. From then on, he was letter-perfect in following orders of landing signal officers, obeying like a robot, emotions and judgment suppressed by a sort of auto-hypnosis. When it came time to qualify in night landings, much worse on the nerves, as a pilot in the air couldn't see anything but lighted wands, the LSO waves instead of flags, David landed perfectly on his first approach. David kept his mouth shut about his determination not to seek glory as a fighter pilot until he completed all requirements to make permanent his flying status. Then he put in a request for advanced training in multiple engine aircraft. This was embarrassing, as his instructor, who thought so well of his potential, was now his squadron commander, and it was necessary to submit this request through him. Once the litter started through the mill, he was called to his boss's stateroom. "Dave, what is this?"
"Just what it says, sir. I want to learn to fly the big ones."
"Are you out of your head? You're a fighter pilot. 3 months of this scouting squadron, 1/4 so I can give you a good fitness report, and you do indeed leave for advanced training. As a fighter." David didn't answer. His squadron commander persisted. "David, are you fretting over that silly diaper diploma? Half the pilots in the fleet have won it. Hell, man, I've got one myself. It didn't hurt you with your shipmates. It just made you look human when you were beginning to suffer from too tight a halo." David still did not comment.
"Damn it. Don't just stand there. Take this letter and tear it up. Then submit one for fighter training. I'll let you go now instead of waiting 3 months."
Dave stood mute. His boss looked at him and turned red, then said softly, "Maybe I was wrong. Maybe you don't have what it takes to be a fighter, Mr. Lamb. That's all. Dismissed." In the big ones, the multi-engine flying boats, David at last found his home. They were too big to fly from a carrier at sea. Instead, duty with them counted as sea duty, although in fact David almost always slept at home. His own bed, his own wife, save for an occasional night as duty officer when he slept at the base, and still less frequent occasions when the big boats flew at night. They did not fly too often, even in daylight and fine weather. They were expensive to fly, too expensive to risk, and the country was going through an economy wave. They flew with full crews, 4 or 5 for two-engine boats, more for four-engine boats, and often with passengers to permit people to get flying time to qualify for that extra pay. All of this suited Dave. No more nonsense of trying to navigate while doing 16 other things. No more relying on the judgment of a landing signal officer. No more depending on just one neurotic engine. No more worries about running out of gas. True, given a choice, he would always make every landing himself. But when he was ranked out of this by a senior pilot, he did not let his worry show, and in time ceased to worry, as all big boat pilots were careful and disposed to live a long time.
These years David spent comfortably while being promoted 2 ranks. Then war broke out.
There were always wars that century, but not always everywhere. This one included practically every nation on Earth. David took a dim view of war. In his opinion, the purpose of a navy was to appear so fierce as to make it unnecessary to fight. But he was not asked. And it was too late to worry, too late to resign, nor was there anywhere to run. So he did not worry about what he could not help, which was good, as the war was long, bitter, and involved millions of deaths. Grandfather Lazarus, what did you do during this war?
Me? I sold Liberty Bonds and made 4-minute speeches and served both on a draft board and a rationing board and made other valuable contributions until the president called me to Washington, and what I did then was hush-hush, and you wouldn't believe it if I told you. None of your lip, boy. I was telling you what David did. Old David was an authentic hero. He was cited for gallantry and awarded a decoration, one that figures into the rest of his story. Dave had resigned himself to, or looked forward to, as may be, retiring at the rank of lieutenant commander, as there weren't many billets higher than that in the flying boats. But the war jumped him to lieutenant commander in a matter of weeks, then to commander a year later, and finally to captain. 4 wide gold stripes, without facing a selection board, taking a promotion examination, or commanding a vessel. The war was using him up fast, and anyone not killed was promoted as long as he kept his nose clean. Dave's nose was clean. He spent part of the war patrolling his country's coasts for enemy underwater vessels. Combat duty, by definition, but hardly more dangerous than peacetime practice. He also spent a tour turning clerks and salesmen into flyers. He had one assignment in a zone where actual fighting was going on, and there he won his medal. I don't know the details, but heroism often consists in keeping your head in an emergency and doing the best you can with what you have instead of panicking and being shot in the tail. People who fight this way win more battles than do intentional heroes. A glory hound often throws away the lives of his mates, as well as his own. But to be officially a hero requires luck, too. It is not enough to do your job under fire exceptionally well. It is necessary that someone, as senior as possible, see what you do and write it up. David had that bit of luck and got his medal. He finished the war in his nation's capital, in the Naval Bureau of Aeronautics, in charge of development of patrol planes. Perhaps he did more good there than he did in combat, since he knew those multi-engine craft as well as any man alive, and this job put him in position to cut out obsolete nonsense and push through some improvements. As may be, he finished the war at a desk, shuffling papers and sleeping at home. Then the war ended. Dave looked around and sized up the prospects. There were hundreds of Navy captains, who, like himself, had been lieutenants only 3 years earlier. Since the peace was forever, as politicians always insist, few would ever be promoted. Dave could see that he would not be promoted. He had neither the seniority, the traditionally approved pattern of service, nor the right connections, political and social. What he did have was almost 20 years' service, the minimum on which to retire at half pay. Or he could hang on until he was forced to retire through failure to be selected for admiral. There was no need to decide at once. 20-year retirement was a year or two off. But he did retire, almost at once, for medical reasons.
The diagnosis was psychosis situational, meaning that he went crazy on the job. Ira, I don't know how to evaluate this. Dave impressed me as one of the few completely sane men I ever knew. But I wasn't there when he retired, and psychosis situational was the second commonest cause for medical retirement of naval officers in those days, but, how could they tell? Being crazy was no handicap to a naval officer, any more than it was to an author, a school teacher, a preacher, or several other esteemed occupations. As long as Dave showed up on time and signed paperwork some clerk prepared and never talked back to his seniors, it would never show. I recall one naval officer who had an amazing collection of ladies' garters. He used to lock himself into his stateroom and examine them. And another one who did exactly the same with a collection of paper stickers used for postage. Which one was crazy? Or both? Or neither?
Another aspect of Dave's retirement requires knowledge of the laws at the time.
Retiring on 20 years' service paid half pay, subject to income tax, which was heavy. Retiring from medical disability paid three-quarters pay and was not subject to income tax. I don't know. I just don't know. But the whole matter fits Dave's talent for maximum results with minimum effort. Let's stipulate that he was crazy. But was he crazy like a fox? There were other features of his retirement. He judged correctly that he had no chance of being selected for admiral. But that citation for gallantry carried with it an honorary promotion on retirement. So Dave wound up the first man in his class to become admiral without ever commanding a ship, much less a fleet. One of the youngest admirals in history, by his true age. I conjecture that this amused the farm boy who hated to plow behind a mule. For at heart he still was a farm boy. There was another law for the benefit of veterans of that war. One intended to compensate lads who had had their educations interrupted by having to leave home to fight. Subsidized education. 1 month for every month of wartime service. This was intended for young conscripts, but there was nothing to keep a career officer from taking advantage of it. Dave could claim it, and did. With three-quarters pay, not subject to taxation, with the subsidy, also not taxable, of a married veteran going to school, Dave had about the income he had had on active duty. More, really, as he no longer had to buy pretty uniforms or keep up expensive social obligations. He could loaf and read books, dress as he pleased, and not worry about appearances. Sometimes he would stay up late and prove that there were more optimists playing poker than mathematicians, then sleep late, for he never, never got up early. Nor did he ever again go up in an aeroplane. Dave had never trusted flying machines. They were much too high in case they stalled. They had never been anything to him but a means to avoid something worse. Once they had served his purpose, he put them aside as firmly as he had put aside fencing foils, and with no regrets in either case. Soon he had another diploma, one which stated that he was a Bachelor of Science in Agronomy, a scientific farmer. The certificate, with the special preference extended to veterans, could have obtained him a civil service job, telling other people how to farm. Instead, he took some of the money that had piled up in the bank while he loafed in school and went back into those hills he had left a quarter of a century earlier and bought a farm. That is, he made a down payment, with mortgage on the balance through a government loan at a subsidized, of course, very low rate of interest. Did he work the farm? Let's not be silly. Dave never took his hands out of his pockets. He made one crop with hired labor while he negotiated still another deal. Ira, the completion of Dave's grand plan involves one factor so unbelievable that I must ask you to take it on faith. It is too much to ask any rational man to understand it. At that pause between wars, Earth held over 2 billion people, at least half on the verge of starvation. Nevertheless, and here's where I must ask you to believe that I was there and would not lie to you. Despite this shortage of food, which never got better other than temporarily and locally in all the years that followed, and could not, for reasons we need not go into, in spite of this disastrous shortage, the government of David's country paid farmers not to grow food. Don't shake your head. The ways of God and government and girls are all mysterious, and it is not given to mortal man to understand them. Never mind that you yourself are a government. Go home tonight and think about it. Ask yourself if you know why you do what you do, and come back tomorrow and tell me. As may be, David never made but one crop. The following year his acreage was soil banked, and he received a fat check for not working it, which suited him just fine. Dave loved those hills. He had always been homesick for them. He had left them simply to avoid work. Now he was being paid not to work in them, which suited him. He had never thought that their charms were enhanced by plowing and getting them all dusty. The soil bank payments took care of the mortgage, and his retired pay left a tidy sum over, so he hired a man and getting them all dusty. The soil bank payments took care of the mortgage, and his retired pay left a tidy sum over, so he hired a man to do those chores a farm requires even though it is not being worked for a crop. Feed the chickens, milk a cow or two, tend a vegetable garden and some fruit trees, repair fences. While the hired man's wife helped David's wife with the house. For himself, David bought a hammock. But David was not a harsh employer. He suspected that cows did not want to be waked at 5 a.m. any more than he did, and he undertook to find out. He learned that cows would happily change their circadian to more reasonable hours, given the chance. They had to be milked twice a day. They were bred for that. But 9 a.m. suited them for a first milking quite as well as 5, as long as it was regular. But it did not stay that way. Dave's hired man had the nervous habit of work. To him, there was something sinful in milking a cow that late. So Dave let him have his way, and hired man and cows went back to their old habits. As for Dave, he strung that hammock between 2 shade trees and put a table by it to hold a frosty drink. He would get up in the morning when he woke, whether it was 9 or noon, then walk slowly to his hammock to rest up for lunch. The hardest work he did was endorsing checks for deposit, and once a month balancing his wife's checkbook. He quit wearing shoes. He did not take a newspaper or listen to radio. He figured that the Navy would let him know if another war broke out. And another did break out about the time he started this routine. But the Navy had no need for retired admirals. Dave paid little attention to that war. It was depressing. Instead, he read everything the State Library had on ancient Greece and bought books about it. It was a soothing subject, one he had always wanted to know more about. Each year on Navy Day, he got all spruced up and dressed as an admiral with all his medals, from the Good Conduct Medal of an enlisted man to the one for bravery under fire that had made him an admiral. Let his hired man drive him to the county seat, and there addressed a luncheon of the Chamber of Commerce on some patriotic subject. I don't know why he did this. Perhaps it was noblesse oblige. Or it may have been his odd sense of humor. But each year they invited him. Each year he accepted. His neighbors were proud of him. He was the epitome of local boy makes good. Then comes home and lives as his neighbors lived. His success brought credit to them all. They liked it that he was still just home folks. And if they noticed that he never did a lick of work, nobody mentioned it. I've skipped lightly over Dave's career, Ira. Had to. I haven't mentioned the automatic pilot he thought up, then had developed years later when he was in a position to get such things done. Nor the overhaul he made of the duties of the crew of a flying boat. Except to say now that it was to get more done with less effort while leaving the command pilot with nothing to do save to stay alert. Or to snore on his co-pilot's arm if the situation did not require his alertness. He made changes in instruments and controls, too, when at last he found himself in charge of development for all Navy patrol planes. Let it go with this. I don't think Dave thought of himself as an efficiency expert, but every job he ever held, he simplified. His successor always had less work to do than his predecessor. That his successor usually reorganized the job again to make 3 times as much work and require 3 times as many subordinates says little about Dave's oddity other than by contrast. Some people are ants by nature. They have to work, even when it's useless. Few people have a talent for constructive laziness. And so ends the tale of the man who was too lazy to fail. Let's leave him there, in his hammock under the shade trees. So far as I know, he is still there. Variations on a theme. 3. Domestic problems. After more than 2,000 years, Lazarus, Why not, Ira? Dave was my age, near enough as not to matter. I'm still here.
Yes, but was David Lamb a member of the families? Under another name? There is no Lamb in the lists.
I never asked, Ira. Nor did he ever offer me a password. In those days, a member kept the fact to himself.
Or, if he was, Dave might not have known it, since he left home so young and so abruptly.
Back then, a youngster wasn't told until he or she was old enough to think about marriage. 18 for boys, usually, and 16 for girls. Reminds me what a shock it was when I was told, at less than 18. By Grant, because I was about to do something foolish. Son, one of the weirdest things about the human animal is that it grows up physically years and years before its brain grows up. I was 17, young and horny, and wanted to get married the worst way. Gramp took me out behind the bar and he convinced me that it was indeed the worst way. Woody, he said, if you want to elope with this girl, nobody will stop you. I told him, belligerently, that nobody could stop me because just over the state line I could swing it without my parents' consent. That's what I'm telling you, he said. Nobody will stop you, but nobody will help you. Not your parents, not your other grandparents, nor me. Not a one of us will even stake you to the price of a marriage license, much less help you support a wife. Not a dollar, Woody. Not a thin dime. If you don't believe me, ask any of them. I said sullenly that I didn't want any help. Gramp had bushy eyebrows that shot up. Well, well, he said. Is she gonna support you? Have you looked at the help wanted in the paper lately? If not, be sure to do so. And glance at the financial section while you're about it. Reading help wanted ads won't take you more than 30 seconds. He added, oh, you can find a job peddling suck brooms from door to door on commission, which will give you fresh air, healthy exercise, and an opportunity to demonstrate your charm, of which you don't have much. But you won't sell vacuum cleaners. Nobody is buying. I didn't know what he was talking about. This was January 1930. Does that date mean anything to you?
I'm afraid not, Lazarus. Despite much study of the family's history, I have to convert those earlier dates into galactic standard in order to feel them.
Don't know as it would be mentioned in the family's records, Ira. The country, well, the whole planet, had just taken a plunge into an economic fluctuation. Depressions, they called them. There were no jobs to be had, at least not for a smart-aleck youngster who didn't know anything useful. Which Gramp realized, having been through several of these swings. But not me. I was sure I could grab the world by the tail and swing it over my shoulder. What I didn't know was that graduate engineers were taking jobs as janitors, and lawyers were driving milk wagons, and ex-millionaires were jumping out windows, but I was too busy sniffing after girls to notice.
Senior, I've read about economic depressions, but I've never understood what caused them. Lazarus Long went tisk-tisk.
And yet you are in charge of a whole planet?
Perhaps I shouldn't be, I admitted.
Don't be so confounded humble. I'll let you in on a secret. At that time, nobody knew what caused them. Even the Howard Foundation might have gone broke had not Ira Howard left firm instructions about how the fund must be handled. On the other hand, everybody, right down to street sweepers and professors of economics, was certain they knew both causes and cures. So, almost every remedy was tried, and none worked. That depression continued until the country blundered into a war, which didn't cure what was wrong. It just masked the symptoms with a high fever.
Well, what was wrong, Grandfather? I persisted.
Do I look smart enough to answer that, Ira? I've gone broke many times. Sometimes financially, sometimes through abandoning my baggage to save my skin. Be darned if I'll offer any fancy explanations, but what happens when you control machinery by positive feedback?
I was startled. I'm not sure I understand you, Lazarus. One doesn't control machinery by positive feedback. At least, I can't think of a case. Positive feedback will cause any system to oscillate out of control.
Go to the head of the class, Ira. I'm suspicious of arguments by analogy, but from what I've seen over the centuries, there doesn't seem to be anything that a government can do to an economy that doesn't act as positive feedback, or as a brake, or both. Maybe someday, somewhere, someone smart as Andy Libby will figure out a way to tinker with the law of supply and demand to make it work better, instead of letting it go its own cruel way. Maybe, but I've never seen it. Though God knows everybody has tried. Always with the best of intentions. Good intentions are no substitute for knowing how a buzzsaw works, Ira. The worst criminals in history have been loaded with good intentions. But you got me sidetracked into making a speech when I was telling you how I happened not to get married. Sorry, Grandfather. Huh. Can't you be rude occasionally? I'm a garrulous old man who has crowded you into wasting time listening to trivia. You ought to resent it. I grinned at him. So, I resent it. You are a garrulous old man who demands that I cater to your every whim. And I am a very busy man with serious matters worrying me, and you've wasted half a day of my time telling me a yarn. Pure fiction, I feel certain, about a man who was so lazy he always succeeded. Intended to irritate me, I think. When you implied that this fictional character was a long-lifer, you evaded a simple question about it and started talking about your grandfather. This, Admiral Ram, you said? Was he redheaded? Lamb, Ira. Donald Lamb. Or was that his brother? That's been a long time. Huh. Odd that you should ask about his hair, as that reminds me of another naval officer in that same war who was just the opposite of Donald. David? Just the opposite of David in every respect, save that he had hair so red that Loki would have been proud of it. He tried to choke a Kodiak bear to death. Didn't work, of course. It doesn't seem possible that you've ever seen a Kodiak bear, Ira. The fiercest carnivore that Earth ever spawned, and outweighed a man 10 to 1. Claws like scimitars, long yellow teeth, bad breath, and a worse disposition. Yet Leif tackled him with bare hands, and mind you, when he had no need to. I would have faded over the horizon. Want to hear about Leif and the bear and the Alaskan salmon? Not now. It sounds like another whopper. You were telling me why you didn't get married. Ah, so I was. Gramp had just asked me, well, Woody, how long has she been pregnant? No, he was explaining that you couldn't support a wife. Son, if you know this story, you tell it to me. I emphatically denied any such thing, to which Gramp replied that I lied in my teeth because that was the only reason a 17-year-old boy ever wanted to get married. His answer made me especially angry because I had a note in my pocket reading, Woodsy, dearest, you have knocked me up and all is chaos. Grant persisted, and I denied it 3 times, getting angrier and angrier, seeing as how it was true. Finally, he says, okay, you've just been holding hands. Has she shown you a pregnancy test report signed by a doctor? Ira, I accidentally told the truth. Why, no, I admitted. All right, he said. I'll take care of it. But only this once. From here on, always use merry widows, even if a sweet little darling tells you not to bother. Or haven't you found a drugstore that'll sell them to you? Then, after swearing me to secrecy, he told me about the Howard Foundation and what it would pay if I married a girl on their approved list. And that was that. As I got this letter from a lawyer on my 18th birthday, just as Gramp had predicted, and it turned out that I fell madly in love with a girl on their list. We got married and had a slew of kids before she turned me in on another model. Your ancestress, no doubt. No, sir, I'm descended from your 4th wife, Grandfather. My 4th, huh? Let me see. Meg Hardy? I think she was your 3rd, Lazarus. Evelyn Foote. Oh, yes. Oh, fine girl, Evelyn. Plump, oof, and pretty. And sweet-natured, and fertile as a turtle. A good cook, and never a harsh word. They don't hardly make 'em anymore. Maybe 50 years younger than I was, but it barely showed. My hair didn't start to gray until I was 150. No secret about my age, since birth date and track record and so forth were on file for each of us. Son, thank you for reminding me of Evelyn. She restored my faith in matrimony when I was, getting a little sour on it. Did the archive show anything else about her? Just that you were her second husband, and that she had 7 children by you. I was hoping there was a photograph. Such a pretty thing, always smiling. She was married to one of my cousins, a Johnson.